WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. How did America become so obsessed with the private lives of celebrities? To get some clues, my guest Neil Gabler went back to the life of Walter Winchell, the reporter who invented the modern gossip column. Winchell became a celebrity by revealing the secrets of celebrities. In the late 30s and early 40s, his gossip column was syndicated in about 2,000 papers. In his radio broadcasts, Winchell reported a mix of gossip and news, all delivered in an urgent tone.
Now to the editorial room of the Jurgens Journal and Walter Winchell.
Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. North and South American. All the ships at sea. Let's go to press. New York City. The Hudson River ice floes prevented the police launches from finding the body of the man who jumped from the George Washington Bridge a few hours ago. He was middle-aged and about 5'6". New York City. Attention, Hamilton, Ontario. Tragedy struck at the Fifth Avenue mansion of Dr. and Josephine Benedict Sharp today. The 27-year-old heiress to the Benedict typewriter fortune swallowed about 50 sleeping pills after a violent quarrel with her husband. Hollywood. The drummer in the Harry James Orchestra was arrested and charged with being a dope fiend today. He said the heroin he used cost him $450 an ounce. Morristown, New Jersey. Andrew Lord, a banker.
If you're too young to remember Winchell's broadcast, you may recognize his voice as the narrator on The Untouchables. Winchell left yet another legacy as a rabid red baiter in the McCarthy era. Neil Gabler is the author of the new book Walter Winchell, Gossip, Power, and the Culture of Celebrity. Gabler is a former host of the PBS movie review show Sneak Previews and the author of a previous book about the early movie tycoons. I asked Gabler what kind of gossip Walter Winchell reported.
He reported on almost everything. He would report who was having an affair with whom, who was divorcing whom, who was having financial problems, who was consorting with gangsters, who was going to have a baby, or who just had a baby, who was taking drugs. Almost nothing was off limits for him. And the revolutionary element of this was that prior to Winchell, if you were to report on a scandal in a mainstream newspaper, it was almost always the product of a court case, so that there was a court record that then entitled you to report on the court events. But when Winchell came along, he required no court record. He would print gossip as we know it, things that he'd heard, rumors that had been unverified.
He would sometimes use his column to be cruel and vindictive. I mean, you could quote his autobiography in which he said, "I wait until I can catch an ingrate with his fly open, and then I take a picture. You botch me, I botch you."
That's vintage Winchell. I mean, that is vintage Winchell. There was an edge to his column and to his broadcast, and it was one of the things that made him popular, as it makes, you know, a Rush Limbaugh or a Howard Stern popular today. I mean, you'd listen to Winchell because all the rules of civility that had governed the media were also suddenly thrown off. So not only did he extend the purview of the media by moving into the world of privacy, but he also changed the terms in which those things were being expressed. I mean, that edge, that vindictiveness, that vituperation was something that, I mean, listeners and readers love that sort of thing.
How did he use his column to get even? What kind of slights would he take revenge against?
Well, I mean, they could be very, very small. Someone saying something about him that he didn't like. Someone on the wrong side of the political fence, that is the other side of the fence from Winchell. I mean, those sorts of things would drive him to distraction. But primarily it came down to whether you're on Winchell's side or not on Winchell's side. And anyone who said anything negative about Winchell was certain to receive the wrath of the column.
I guess the worst thing he could do to you is put you on his drop-dead list. What was the list?
The drop-dead list, or the DDL list, was the worst form of punishment for a press agent. Now, ultimately, most of these celebrities reached the column through press agents. And if it turned out that you had given Winchell a bum steer, or it turned out that you had given Winchell something that had been published in another column, or if you had boasted to people that you could get something into Winchell's column, I mean, there were a number of offenses. You would be placed on that DDL list, and which meant that he would not put any of your items into his column. Now, for a press agent who lived and died by Winchell's column, this was the very worst form of punishment because it could cost you your livelihood.
So, yeah, because Winchell was not only putting in the things you didn't want printed about your life, he was also putting in the things you wanted planted about
exactly.
yourself or your client.
Well, the idea was, you know, that no publicity is bad publicity, ultimately. I mean, that was an idea that took a while for the celebrities to realize, but it was one that they eventually came to accept. And the rule of thumb for Winchell was that you would give him five items about individuals who were not your clients, or five jokes that he used in the column. And for those, he would then repay you with one mention of one of your clients. So it was a kind of 5-to-1 ratio. That was the barter system in the column.
Now, what was it like for a press agent who gave an item to one of his competitors? Would he punish them for that?
No. I mean, Winchell would read his competitors. In fact, he would read his competitors aloud. Winchell loved to hold court. It was one of the things he loved doing most. He would read his competitors aloud, and he would say, well, I see that my rejects have wound up in these garbage cans. He was not a man of much generosity. In fact, I mean, one of the stories I love about Winchell is that he would read the proofs of an article or a column of someone who wasn't even famous, someone who was a very marginal journalistic figure, and he would then correct it and write on it and send it off to the writer. As if, you know, Winchell was everywhere. Winchell, there was nothing that was beneath Winchell's vigilance.
My guest is Neil Gabler, the author of a new book about Walter Winchell and the culture of celebrity. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Neil Gabler, the author of a new biography of Walter Winchell. Did Walter Winchell ruin any careers?
Well, the most obvious career that he ruined was Josephine Baker's. Josephine Baker came to the United States after many, many years in France and was performing first in Miami Beach and then in New York. And she ran afoul of Walter Winchell in a long series of events that began when she went to the Stork Club, which was Walter Winchell's hangout, and felt that they were taking an unconscionably long time to serve her. She thought that it was because she was black. She protested to the NAACP. They immediately sent pickets around the Stork Club. And they asked Walter Winchell, who, oddly enough, for people who know his later politics, was a strong advocate of civil rights, they asked Walter Winchell to condemn the racism at the Stork Club. Well, Winchell issued a blanket condemnation, but he didn't single out the Stork Club. And this disturbed the NAACP, who wanted Winchell to come down specifically against the Stork Club. Winchell felt that in doing so, he would be violating his friendship to Sherman Billingsley, who was the Stork Club's proprietor. And to make a long story short, he got into a battle with the NAACP and with Josephine Baker. He called Josephine Baker everything from a communist to a fascist, though he could never explain how she could be both simultaneously. But ultimately, by doing that, he drove Baker out of the country and destroyed her career here.
Did stars ever rebel against Winchell through, for instance, lawsuits?
Winchell always bragged that he had never lost a libel suit, but that was in fact not true. He did lose libel suits. In fact, he lost one in 1932. He was sued by the Fleetwood Beach Club. He had accused the Beach Club of being run by mobsters. He was angry at them because they had, he felt, through false pretenses, put his name on their board of governors. He was very angry. The Fleetwood Beach Club sued him, and he lost the suit. And he was asked to pay part of the damage. He was incensed that he would have to pay part of the judgment, and he went on strike. And at that time, he was working for The Mirror, which was a Hearst newspaper. One day, he walked into the Stork Club, and this was all done in advance. They knew he was coming, and he got a phone call from William Randolph Hearst, who at that time was at San Simeon. And Hearst said, Walter, you've got to come back to the paper. What can I do to placate you? And Walter said, the only thing you can do to placate me is to give me indemnification against libel. Hearst said, Winchell was important enough that Hearst said yes. So that even though Winchell was sued, he was never responsible for any libel judgment after that period, so that he could say whatever he wanted to say with impunity.
One of the things Winchell became famous for, besides his gossip column, was, of course, his radio broadcast, and we got a taste of his rat-a-tat style a little earlier. How did he develop that broadcasting persona?
That's a very interesting thing, because Winchell obviously was a print journalist. When he moved to radio, he had to develop for himself not only a persona, a radio persona, but also a radio format. He couldn't simply read the column on radio. He had to create something new. And he created what we now call infotainment. He would read the news in a highly dramatic style. He would, deliver gossip one moment and then a political editorial the next. And the effect was surrealistic. I mean, the commingling of 10,000 people have died in Ethiopia 1 second, and then the very next second, and Joan Crawford is getting a divorce from Francia Tone. I mean, those things juxtaposed was the had the oddest kind of effect on a listener, because it democratized everything. It democratized the greatest events and the most trivial events and put them at the same level. And it took Winchell a while to perfect that style. He began on the Lucky Strike Hour before he even had his own program, working to speed up his delivery in the belief that if you talked fast enough, there was not only a sense of urgency, but people wouldn't exactly know what you were saying.
That would be good?
And that would be good because most of the stuff he said was ephemeral and trivial. But if you read it with enough urgency, and if it raced by your ear quickly enough, you wouldn't know.
How did journalists in Winchell's time react to his blurring of the lines between news and entertainment?
Initially, Winchell was embraced, surprisingly, by the intellectual community, who found in him this strange, primitive novelty. This man who used language in extraordinary ways, who did things that no other journalist would do, and they found him to be, amusing and in some ways, important as a symbol of the popular culture. But after Roosevelt died, Winchell really lost his political bearings. And from a man who was a liberal and a populist in the 30s and through the war, he became a man who moved increasingly to the right, and in the process lost a good many of his allies and a good deal of his readership and listenership. So that journalists who were saying in the 20s and 30s that Walter Winchell had brought life and verve to journalism, that journalism had been gray and pallid before Winchell and was colorful and exciting after Winchell, were now saying that Winchell's unreason, Winchell's appeal to passion, that Winchell's power itself was dangerous and that it had a deleterious effect on the media. And that transition happened over roughly a 10 or 15-year period from the 30s to the post-war period, by which time many, many people felt that Walter Winchell was a very, very dangerous force in America.
Walter Winchell rewrote the rules for what it was permissible to report on. How do you think the rules have changed since Winchell's death?
The edge of the envelope keeps on being pushed and pushed and pushed. Even in Winchell's lifetime, it was pushed. There were certain things that Winchell would not talk about. For example, he wouldn't talk about homosexuality. He was very homophobic, but it just wasn't something that he generally included in his column. But by the 1950s, once Winchell had loosed the gossip, over that 20-year period from the late 20s, early 30s to the early 50s, there were other vehicles that had come along that had moved far beyond what Winchell was doing. Confidential magazine, for example, which would report on the sexual practices of almost any movie star. And homosexuality was not off limits for Confidential magazine. And I think one can trace from Winchell through Confidential magazine to People magazine or any of the tabloids, the supermarket tabloids today, or not even the supermarket tabloids, but the so-called mainstream tabloids, just the expansion of the kinds of things that a journalist feels he's entitled to write about. And there is almost nothing today that's off limits.
I think one of the differences in Winchell's day, Winchell might have reported on some of this stuff, but there weren't, talk shows in which celebrities would voluntarily go on themselves and offer dark secrets to the public.
Well, that happened by the late 50s. And Winchell himself recognized what a great change this was going to affect in the column. When he was the only one dispensing this material, it was one thing. And it gave him a monopoly of, as we've already said, extraordinary proportions. But when celebrities themselves realized that they could avoid the middleman. They could go to television directly, or they could go to a journalist directly, and they could tell their own stories. That really had an enormous impact on Winchell personally. I think it helped rob the column of its immediacy and its importance.
My guest is Neil Gabler, the author of a new biography of Walter Winchell. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Neil Gabler, author of a new book about Walter Winchell, Gossip, Power, and the Culture of Celebrity. You write that Walter Winchell understood the bitter subtext of gossip. It wasn't just voyeurism. It was a weapon of empowerment for the readers and listeners. How so?
Well, you have to understand that what we have to look at what gossip does. And what gossip does is it rips down the wall between us and them. It shows us them, and by that, of course, I mean, you know, celebrities, in their least admirable characteristics. And this is something that I think we can't stress enough, is how powerful that idea is, that celebrities are no better than we are. In point of fact, they may be worse. That we know more about them than they know about us. That we have a kind of superiority. I mean, that is a very important subtext of gossip, in my estimation, and it's one that Walter Winchell understood, which is why his gossip usually had that nasty edge, that little diggy edge to it. He didn't only tweak celebrities. He liked to really twist the knife in them. And I think he did that, again, because he understood that gossip is a populist form.
Do you think celebrity journalism goes too far now? Does a lot of celebrity journalism disturb you?
I don't. Celebrity journalism doesn't disturb me if it's segregated to its proper place. I think the real problem, and this is a problem that Walter Winchell did not have, although he was in part responsible for introducing the problem to us, is that in Walter Winchell's day, there was a strict segregation between the tabloids and the respectable press. No one would have ever confused the New York World or the Herald Tribune or the New York Times with Winchell's Mirror or the Graphic or the Daily News. These were distinct entities doing distinct things and purveying distinct cosmologies about how the world operated. But through the years, over the decades, we have seen a convergence that the respectable press and the tabloid press come closer and closer and closer and closer. And today, celebrity journalism is not segregated to the tabloids or to celebrity magazines. Celebrity journalism is everywhere.
I guess one of the things I worry about is that I think we're ruining a lot of really good talent by creating celebrities who cease to become real to us. I mean, I think at a certain level of celebrity in America, you are so hounded by the press and by photographers who are laying in wait for you that it starts to deform your character. And I think a lot of talented people start to lose their talent because it's just impossible to keep your bearings once you're in that high celebrity world.
Well, certainly, I mean, this book of Walter Winchell is a cautionary tale about that very thing, about a man who became his persona, and then when performed in this show that was his life, and then when the show closed, he was still in costume, but there was no place for him to go. Today, I think what's interesting is that celebrities, and to take the situation that you've just described, celebrities make their lives into their art so that their lives are parallel to the movies they make. Demi Moore may be on the cover of Vanity Fair making a career out of having a baby, even when she doesn't have a film in circulation. And that is a form of entertainment. The life itself becomes a form of entertainment for our edification. We want to read about these celebrities, chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, and these ongoing sagas. I mean, Elizabeth Taylor is another example of that. The woman hasn't made a movie in years and years and years, unless you include the Flintstone cameo. But she can get on the cover of People magazine anytime she wants because her life is the entertainment. Her life is the movie.
Well, Neil Gabler, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Neil Gabler is the author of a new biography of Walter Winchell.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, winds up another Jurgen's Journal until next Sunday night at the very same time. Until then, and with lotions of love, I remain your New York correspondent, Walter Winchell, who can remember all the way back when Time magazine, which knowingly employed ex-communists as senior editors, was famous for its red cover instead of its red face. Good night.